You are listening to a sermon by Ken Friesen, recorded on Sunday, April 22, 2012, at the Point Grey Interminonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
Thanks, Andre. Andre clearly knows a lot about Israel and Palestine and the question there. And his email he sent to me in advance of this kind of put me to shame in a way on his amount of knowledge in this area. And my knowledge, while generally I'm a reader of papers and follower of current events, about Israel and Palestine was somewhat limited before I went. And this is one of the reasons why I went. I'm on the board for MCC, Mennonite Central Committee, for the last 10 years. And questions about Palestine and Israel come out up in the context of their work in Palestine and Israel. And so it comes before the board, and so that's an area of interest for me as well. Mm-hmm. So I got to go with approximately 12 or 11 others from the BC region, a couple of people from MCC, and a number of pastors, including Arthur Bergen, who's here today, who is a pastor to German churches, I think, German-speaking churches in British Columbia, but is now on sabbatical, and Carl Friesen, who you heard from last week. And it was about a 12-day tour of Israel and Palestine, primarily focused on listening to our partners in Palestine. And the area in which we have offices is in Jerusalem and in Bethlehem. And Bethlehem is just, Marple to Kerrisdale, frankly. And Bethlehem is on what we know as the West Bank. It is Palestinian. And then Jerusalem is, as we know, has different quarters. Some are Muslim quarters, and some are the Jewish quarters, and some are Armenian quarters. So it's a broad mix of individuals. And so our work historically as MCC in that region has been in the context of then coming out a year after Israel was declared, and a year after the Palestinians were pushed from their land over to primarily the West Bank and Gaza. And in keeping with our focus on helping the dispossessed, our focus has been in working with Palestinians, and because of their plight in being landless and being economically disadvantaged. And Andre, in his introduction, said that I'm mostly going to be speaking about the voices that we've heard. And that degree is true, but not substantially, because as I started to undergo this writing of this talk, what really is always kind of came to the top of my head was my role as a board member of MCC and how I look at the work of MCC in Israel and Palestine in the context of our work, MCC generally, and the work of MCC in relationship to its members, the church. So, as I started looking at this topic, I thought back some almost 20 years when I gave my first talk here, and very long time ago. And my first talk here was on our peace position. And in that talk, I referenced Israel and the secular nature of Israel and the difficulty of applying ideas about pacifism in the context of a secular state, and the need for a secular state to live in the real world, as it were. And at that time, Cynthia and I were considering, or wanting, frankly, is that why we pushed up the date of our marriage, so that we could go perhaps work for MCC, and we were in application with them. They, for some reason, in the application process, were concerned about my quote-unquote peace position, and I submitted that sermon. So that's how I can place it in context, being 20 years ago, because that's when we applied for our position with MCC, which never worked out. And I had a couple talks with people that actually our application came across their desk. So what happened? And it was just sort of one of these things where things dropped through the cracks, and it was unfortunate. But I, in a way, I found a way to work within the context of the MCC, and that has been meaningful to me. All right. Before I went on my trip to Israel, a lot of my friends, Jewish friends, frankly, and others, asked me what I hope to learn from this trip. And I thought about that really in the context of my work, as I say, at MCC. And specifically, I wanted to look at MCC work in the area of peacemaking and what that looks like in practice. Of course, as board members, we have to look at the effectiveness of programs and methods. And this is an important element of our faith position and our faith tradition. Now, additionally, the subject of Israel and Palestine, of course, is very controversial by definition. MCC's work in Israel and Palestine is often controversial in the Mennonite community and churches. We have members of our constituent churches who feel strongly convicted that Christians are biblically called upon to provide unflinching and uncritical support for Israel. There are also many people who are part of the MCC constituency and Mennonite churches that feel very angry about the conduct of Israel since its re-inception in 1948 and regard it as an apartheid state, and want MCC and the Mennonite community generally to actively promote a boycott, disinvestment, and sanctions campaign against Israel for their suppression of the Palestinian people. This sort of dichotomy comes before our policy positions in, as we look at how we, as MCC, approach Palestine and Israel in our work there and at our peace position. Before I go further on this, let me back up a bit and talk about some of the changes that have occurred in MCC very recently. Just within this last couple of weeks, MCC, what we know as the sort of the overall overarching MCC control, MCC Binational as it was called, was dissolved. This arose through a process called the New Wineskins process. And the result is that we are no longer governed out of Akron, Ohio, and no longer governed kind of out of a U.S.-based center. And in that, now we have both MCC Canada and MCC U.S. being equals, and with co-equals and other co-equals, we all work together with no sort of lead. One of the other important changes that occurred in the context of this New Wineskins process, and that involved years, frankly, of listening to constituents and having many discussions, part of which where I was in part of those, and the kind of creation of a new constitution and new ideas of mission. But one of the most important elements of change to MCC is listening to its members is that the view was that we've become somewhat detached from its membership, from the churches and from the members generally. Consequently, one of the stated goals of MCC is to actively seek to be a part of the life of its constituency, the Anabaptist Church and members. That is to be in relationship with them and to think of MCC as the charity wing of the churches, actively engage individuals, youth and otherwise, to work within MCC, giving the youth an opportunity, not just youth but adults, an opportunity to get involved in charitable acts. The purpose of this presentation, and this is where I diverge, from what we talked about, is to consider the work of charity, and specifically MCC, in the life of its church and its members, i.e. us as Christians, and specifically us as Anabaptists. That is, to look at the why, and then the how this is to be facilitated. So I'm going to start with kind of first principles. The role of charity in faith. And for this, I've gone to Karen Armstrong, who is a nun and looks at, was a Catholic nun, and looks basically at the Abrahamic faith in a number of books. A lot of people have read them here. Where she writes, "The principle of compassion lies at the heart of all religious, ethical, and spiritual traditions, calling us always to treat all others as we wish to be treated ourselves. Compassion impels us to work tirelessly to alleviate the suffering of our fellow creatures, to dethrone ourselves from the center of the world and put another there, and to honor the inviolable sanctity of every single human being treating everybody without exception with absolute justice, equity, and respect. MCC defines themselves in this new wineskin process as who, in the context of who is MCC. MCC is the ministry of the church. In this ministry, we serve in the name of Christ, who is the head of the church, and through whom God's work of reconciliation, whether things on earth or things in heaven, takes place. It's based on Colossians 1:18. So MCC and charity should be regarded as a natural extension or arm of the Anabaptist Church. This should be not a surprise, given the most oft-quoted saying of Menno Simons was, true evangelical faith cannot lie dormant. It clothes the naked, feeds the hungry, it comforts the sorrowful, it shelters the destitute. It serves those that harm it, it binds up that which is wounded. It has become all things to all people. We could have sung that, I suppose, but I saw Deborah on, this week in a coffee shop, and I was going to say that, we could sing that, but I just don't like that tune. So that's <what I'm saying. laughs> Menno Simons didn't write that tune, so I can still have a tune. So what are the goals of MCC? Its stated purpose is for MCC is to share God's love and compassion for all in the name of Christ by responding to basic human needs and working for peace and justice. We are to embrace God's requirement for us to act justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. So I'd indicated under the new wineskins there's an explicit emphasis now in strengthening the relationship between the churches and MCC. And so in the new wineskins, they say that what relationship does MCC have with the churches under the new wineskin causes, accompanying partners, and the church in a process of mutual transformation, accountability, and capacity building. Building bridges to connect people and ideas across cultural, political, and economic divides, and caring for creation. It is my view that by and through the acts of service, we can become individually and collectively a blessing, i.e. a positive influence in the name of Christ. Now, there's certainly a pleasure in knowing that we are doing and helping, and that pleasure, that knowing, has its own rewards. And there's a pleasure and satisfaction from knowing that we are doing what God has called us to do. It is taking oneself out of the id, and as God has called us to be aware and concerned about the state of others. This is important for the identity of those of faith, that their faith lived out becomes tangible. There are limitations to this, and the complaint of many involved in just service, that service and good works becomes a replacement of faith. I will leave that for another speaker. But let me speak about my learning tour in Israel and talk about MCC's work was historically and what they're doing now. As we indicated, MCC came to Israel and Palestine in the 1940s, within a year of the creation, recreation of the State of Israel, and just after the ensuing war. MCC began its work in the region by working with displaced Palestinian refugees. And just by way of background, at the time of 1948, there was the whole area of Israel and Palestine had been under English control, part of what was called the Palestinian Mandate. The English got so tired of being bombed by both sides that they threw it at the UN for the UN to solve. And the UN then came up with a plan of partition. And the partition gave Israel part of the area, much smaller than the part that they currently have, and the Palestinians another part. Israel had no land, as it were, other than the land they had purchased. They had no land of their own. And so regarded this as a not everything they wanted, just like any deal, but better than the alternative, which is no deal. And so they took the deal. The Palestinians were disorganized in some manner, and they're in a situation where the countries around them have their own interests that may not be always the Palestinian interests. And so the deal was rejected on the part of the Palestinians, which led, and so when Israel was declared, the countries around them, basically five countries, all declared war on Israel. And but they lost that war. And the lines, what we've known as the Green Line of 1948, is much larger than what had been provided to the Israelis under the UN plan. Now, the Israelis accepted the plan in the beginning, went to war thereafter at the instigation of the countries around, ended up further ahead. The Palestinian land, which was set up for the Palestinians, was in fact taken over by Jordan. And so if you have old pictures of Jerusalem, sometimes it says Jerusalem, comma, Jordan, because that was controlled by Jordan until 1967. So it's now a year after Israel has been declared, and it's after after the war, and we have the new Green Line. At that point, perhaps between 600,000 and 700,000 Palestinians had been pushed out of their former homes in the land known as Israel, then known as Israel. And so it is to that, then MCC became involved, much as it becomes involved in instances of displaced individuals. Into that, actually, is on a very ad hoc basis, then, and in fact, is the creation of the 10,000 villages. 10,000 villages began in 1946 when an FCC worker, Miss Edna Byler, visited Puerto Rico, set up sewing classes, and began importing to her basement then crafts. And that was followed up by a visit with Palestinian refugees and Haitian woodworkers. So that's the very start of the 10,000 villages. An MCC worker, and then they had shops and people on the ground in the Palestinian area trying to do self-help crafts. That led to other things that MCC got involved in terms of water and the typical sort of aid and development. Since that time, we have instead of doing things ourselves, partner with local expertise. Now programs are, for the large part, taken up by local staff. And in the area of Palestine, there's generally no lack of education amongst the local population to undertake programs. So MCC has been supportive in many instances of germinating various organizations. An example of this is one we visited in Bethlehem, but called the Applied Research Institute of Jerusalem, which maps out and studies the various water resources in the West Bank. If you go there, you'd know that water is very sparse, particularly around Jerusalem, and it's quite amazing, frankly, from our Vancouver eyes to see what people are fighting about in terms of land, because it is most desolate around that area. And we were there in the beginnings of spring when it's as green as it gets. But in the context, and just to digress a bit, one of the issues when you have a Palestinian area is that the land which we know as West Bank, which we think in our heads has mostly been under the control of the Palestinians, isn't exactly correct because it's under occupation. And this occupation is similar, very similar, I guess. It's just a modern-day form of occupation that that the Romans had in the time of Jesus. And so there's a lot of the growth of Israeli settlements, those are Israelis settling on the Palestinian side, is actually twice the growth of Israelis in Israel. So there is a concerted effort to take up land on the Palestinian side and to populate with Israeli Jews primarily. And that tends to be the better water, the best water, is resources are taken up by those with occupational capacity. So in institutes like the Applied Research Institute of Jerusalem looks at the water and water losses, I suppose, and the underground capacity to generate water, and maps it out in the context of what land's being maintained and what land is being lost by the Palestinians. So that's an example of a partnership. Another example of a partnership is through an individual named Zubi Zubi. And he is in Bethlehem. He's director of the YM Palestinian Conflict Resolution Center. It's a Armenian Christian organization which deals with all manner of conflict in the West Bank, marital, commercial, and most of all within the wider Palestinian community. And it's to promote, by training people on both sides of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict in peaceful relationship building, nonviolent responses to injustice, conflict, and the promotion of human rights. And so this Mr. Zubi Zubi, he actually came to British Columbia fairly recently and travels through North America talking about what work he does. And a lot of institutions in Palestine are not well-run, and the courts aren't well-run. And so there obviously is a need for commercial and marital and other sort of conflict resolution. And these are kind of organizations that spring up in that context, which MCC has been very involved in, both in ongoing support and in getting going in the first place. Now, there are about 10 to 15 organizations that MCC sponsors in the area, and so those are just some of the examples that we did hear from on the Palestinian side. And I found it, and I recorded a number of these, and my kids said I should have pictures in the background, because when we're kids and you go hear someone that's come from abroad, you always are fascinated by the pictures, and always, you know, you probably have recollections yourself of all that. So I'm sorry, I got no pictures for this, but I found it very fascinating to hear from these individuals, and I felt it was very apropos being in the Middle East and going in and hearing from wise men or wise women and sitting kind of, not at their feet per se, but on chairs and listening to them. And there's a tradition in that area of all coming and listening to individuals, and having elders in the community, and that Mr. Zubi Zubi is certainly an elder in the community. You get served very small cups of very terrible coffee, and then someone tells their story. And that is what we did for originally those 2 weeks. And it was pretty intense, frankly, going around. And Arthur probably could agree with me, is there wasn't much downtime in all of that. Now, we heard from Palestinians, and we also heard from Jewish leaders. Some of those voices were particularly fascinating. We met, for instance, with a settler who had moved to Israel from Chicago some 30 years ago. And he grew up in a fairly secular environment and decided really in his mid-20s that he was going to take up the Jewish cause, the Israeli cause, and come to Israel. He did and settled in a settlement. And these settlements are areas in the West Bank, or not now in Gaza anymore, but just in the West Bank, that are settled by Israelis, and they've been there for some time. And they're a big thorn in the side in any settlement discussions. It is Israeli culture. Well, I shouldn't say that. Middle East culture is full of individuals with disparate views. We have some tough politics sometimes here in BC, I think, but the range of opinion held very strongly is quite remarkable. So within the Israeli community at large, Jewish community, you have individuals obviously at all spectrums. Of course they are, but the commitment to their views is remarkable, probably unflinching in many instances. They're just not, this individual could not and would not foresee settlement on any other terms but the terms which he believed to be appropriate, which means that he was never, ever, ever, ever going to leave his land. And those were his words, actually. And so I'm meeting both sides of the dispute. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I say this too. I mean, in the Palestinian, it persons like Mr. Zoghbi, conflict is rife on the Palestinian side too. So it's part of the culture. I was going to digress. No funny story, I'm afraid, in all of this. So let me digress a moment. This is not a cultural thing just to a Jewish or Muslim group. We attended the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem. And this is where Jesus came off the cross, and they have the area which he was supposed to be laying on. And and five, like many of the churches, they're owned by different co-owned, shall I say, by different organizations. And it's really flex. The different times you have different predominant cultures coming down and owning this area, like the Armenians at one point were the ruling class. And so you have Armenian churches strong there. And so in the case of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, you've got five churches, Catholic, Greek Orthodox, Armenian Orthodox, and a variety of other Orthodox, Russian Orthodox, all having an interest in this church. And it's and so if we put it in this building, it'd be like the MBs being over there and the Mennonite church group being over there, and it's all part of the same church. And all Christian, and they cannot agree upon who holds the key. So a Muslim family has to hold the key, and they held it for at least 500 years, and they're allowed to open the door for the church. And they have a co-agreement this far that nobody is allowed to do any improvements to their portion of their control of the church without the authority of all parties. So they get into fights, fist fights and so on occasionally. And at one instance, likely, one group decided to burn down the Armenian section of the church. And so it is a charred out hull. So you go through and it's beautiful, 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 and then charred burns. And it's been like that for 30 years. And you go like, what? And so they make their petition to the group council to renovate and put back into condition their portion of the church, which was burnt down by one of the others, most likely. So they go to this, and they've been going to it for 30 or 40 years to make this petition. And each time the other group will look at them, say no. So that is the kind of background you have in that area. And it's not unique to any particular religion or cultural group. So one of the most memorable sites that we attended was the Holocaust Museum, Yad Vashem. And that is a very well done and moving museum and exhibit. It's in Jerusalem. And it's just completed a couple of years ago. This is, as I say, a Holocaust museum. And one other site we went to was in Masada, which is where there was a Jewish rebellion against the Roman overlords. At Masada, their fight after a year ended with the Jews committing suicide when they knew that their fight was lost. And from visiting these two institutions and talking to Israelis and looking at what was part of the Israeli sort of ethos, I thought there was, and I've undertaken sort of a three-point statement here, that there's an overriding theme, and that has developed and seems to be underlying the narrative of the country of Israel. And it's really the cultural context of the creation of Israel. And number one, I've indicated, is that the Jews in the diaspora have always been unsafe and subject to the vagaries of capricious Christian and Muslim majorities that will turn on the Jews, whether through a pogrom or, of course, through the Holocaust. Number two, that with the creation of a Jewish state, while the hatred of the Jewish people may continue, the Jews can do what they need to do to protect themselves. Three, The hate and fear that underlies the pogroms and Holocaust will continue and be directed against Israel, and therefore vigilance and aggression must be inculcated into the Jewish culture, so that never again can the Jewish people fail to answer a threat. So that's, people may disagree with that, but that was my view of the lessons being taught at these various historical sites. And it's a lesson that is being, for instance, the Israelis must serve in the military. And the Bad Vashem, the view of the Holocaust, the part of the Israeli, when the new recruits come in, is to attend these museums and go through the history. And so that the supposition, I believe that these suppositions become part of the ideas and the philosophical underpinnings of why they have a military and what the role of the Jewish military personnel is. And then this is what the Palestinians find themselves up against. And it is a history not of their making. They're up against a highly motivated and organized Israeli state, and to this the Palestinians are no match. With that, I'd like to turn to the passage found at Matthew 21 through 25. And I note that we talked about Matthew 5, 13 to 20. I'm not sure how we got there, but this also is relevant, obviously, in the You Are the Light of the World, the city built on the hill. What we read was a section leading up to Matthew 21 through 25. And so I'm going to read through 21 through 25 and talk about it in the context of Israel and Palestine. And so, carrying on from our earlier reading, teaching about anger. You have heard that people were told in the past, do not commit murder. Anyone who does will be brought to trial. But now I tell you, if you are angry with your brother, you'll be brought to trial. If you call your brother, you good for nothing, you'll be brought before the council. And if you call your brother a worthless fool, you'll be in danger of going to the fire of hell. So if you're about to offer your gift to God at the altar, and there you remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift there in front of the altar. Go at once and make peace with your brother, and then come back and offer your gifts to God. If someone brings a lawsuit against you and takes you to court, settle the dispute while there is still time, before you get to court. Once you are there, you'll be turned over to the judge, who will hand you over to the police, and you will be put in jail. There you will stay, I tell you, until you pay the last penny of your fine. There are three basic ideas expressed in this passage, and I would like to concentrate on and deal with them as they relate to the Israeli-Palestinian question. The first point relates to how we are called to treat others with love and respect. That we cannot treat a neighbor poorly and keep a good relationship with God. That it is not appropriate to think one has the freedom to ask God for forgiveness while failing to take appropriate steps with one's neighbor. On the macro level, I don't think collectively the people of Israel can be in a right relationship with God if they mistreat their neighbors, the Palestinians. I don't think having their young people start their adult lives with 2 years of service to their country and engage primarily in the activity of learning how to militarily suppress their neighboring Palestinians is good for Israelis. All of this, I can say, unreservedly, is bad for the Israeli soul. To treat others poorly creates a wrong relationship with your neighbor and a poor relationship with God. This fact, more than anything else, is, in my mind, the basis for a belief that change can occur in Israel and Palestine. That is to say that real and lasting change in the relationship between Israel and Palestine is not likely going to come about through a UN resolution, pressure from our prime minister or threats against Israel emanating from leaders in Iran. Israel, it seems, has become inured to the cacophony of voices, ranging from the well-intentioned to the belligerent. The practical side of life is described at verse 25. Verse 25 is the one that began, if someone brings a lawsuit against you and takes you to the court, you are to settle it before you get there. That's sometimes the advice I give. That is to say, there are practical considerations when you get into disputes. And the practical consideration for Israel, in my mind, can be seen for the state of Israel and for the individual Israelis. For the state, there is increasing isolation and aggravation of the world community, and eventually perhaps censure. And that could mean censure in the form of war or simply more intifadas. For the individual Israelis, the mistreatment of their neighbors can cause all sorts of trouble in the future as revenge may be sought, bringing the need to continually up the level of security or risk acts of revenge. This is the trade-off of control of the occupation. The need to maintain control in the face of opposition means that the resulting increasing tension, like an elastic, is likely increasing to the point that the tension will snap back on the Israelis and the Jews. Whether the damage that is being done to Israel from the mistreatment of Palestinians will end anytime soon, and whether or not the Israeli people and political parties will undertake any significant changes remains to be seen. I have now cited a New Testament passage in making the statement about the mistreatment of the Jewish neighbors. And the mistreatment of the neighbors is bad for the Jewish soul. But this theme, a proper treatment, is found throughout the prophetic tradition. And we talked about it this morning with the passages you chose, where the people were of Israel to express care for the other, the stranger, and where the people of Israel are said to be accountable for exercising justice and compassion. God, it is said, is to have chosen the people of Israel to bring a blessing to all the families of the nations. The voices in Israel emphasizing self-preservation currently drown out those voices calling for Israel to pursue justice and compassion. This brings me to one of the harder questions. This is one of the questions with my hat as a board member on MCC, and that is, what is the role of advocacy in peace work? And from the shared convictions, the new wineskins statement, the approach of MCC is said to be, MCC approaches its mission by addressing poverty, oppression, and injustice, and their systemic causes. Accompanying partners in the church in a process of mutual transformation, accountability, and capacity building, building bridges, connect people and ideas across cultural, political, and economic divides, and caring for creation. How does an organization like MCC deal with systemic causes of the Palestinian situation of oppression, particularly arising in the context of the occupation? Well, let me start by saying that I think the MCC workers in Israel, Bethlehem, and the region generally, are first rate. They're extremely bright and idealistic. They are walking in every way with the oppressed of the area. One of them, another Friesen from Winnipeg, expressed to me that she thought this area of the world is so important because if we can bring peace to this part of the world, then from the lessons learned, it could be a beacon of hope for the rest of the world. This last week, my wife Cynthia was here today. We attended the play out at the Clutch, I think it's called.
Gulch.
Somewhere near a commercial. That's right. And the play was The Last Days of Judas Iscariot. And we have a friend who's playing the role of the defense lawyer who is defending Judas Iscariot in a trial determining whether Judas should be damned or granted a reprieve to heaven. One of the defenses, through various witnesses, was that Judas, who was extremely close to Christ, sought to push Jesus from being the individual who went out and cleaned out the temple to be the individual who could clean out the occupying Romans. And that was the intention of Judas by providing Jesus to the Romans for 30 pieces of silver. That it was his intention not to have Jesus crucified, but rather to have Jesus take the steps that Judas sincerely believed should be Jesus' mandate on earth to rid Israel of the Roman occupation. And given that his intention was not to have Jesus betrayed, but rather to push Jesus to interact with the Romans such that his mission would change in as much as they have a direct conflict between Jesus and the Romans, that Jesus would take the opportunity to exert the power that Judas believed him to have to rid Israel of the Romans. The fact that Jesus refused this opportunity, provided through Judas, is seen immediately with Jesus restoring the ear of the Roman cut off by Peter. If the systemic cause of the Israeli behavior, and by extension the occupation of Palestine, is the Israeli failure to prioritize justice and compassion over military expansion, strength, and power, then I think MCC and Christians generally have a lot to say about systemic causes. If one views the systemic cause of the plight of the Palestinian people is the Israeli military control and expansion, and then the answer to that is to apply economic, political, or military pressure upon Israel with the imposition of some previous border arrangement, then I think peacemaking, at least for Anabaptists, means that we are engaging in political solutions, and that is because the systemic cause is defined in political terms rather than moral and spiritual ones. I would urge us as Anabaptist Christians to define the kind of peacemaking that we bring in the name of Christ to systemic causes of injustice in the case of Israel and Palestine should be defined by a people and state's failure to prioritize compassion over domination and control. And it is that failure that we should speak to. I deal with this question here because of the comments I made in the very beginning as my role in MCC on the board and the disparate views that are held amongst Mennonites from Mennonite churches. And the goal of having our constituency and MCC aligned in a manner that they both can appreciate each other without there being excessive controversy about positions. And so it's in that context that I looked then at this question and then looked at then at this way of looking at our role of peacemaking and our way of looking at systemic, dealing with systemic causes. And it was to reconcile the two that it is in this context that I have addressed this subject. In the meantime, oppression and suffering exist in Palestine and all around our world. My view that our role as MCC is to facilitate our church members and others to express God's requirement to respond to human needs whatever and wherever they may be. Thank you.